Well, I have 45 minutes to prove the existence of God and to do it so that 8th graders will understand and 88-year-olds will understand. So no pressure, right? No problem whatsoever. No, this is the topic, as I mentioned earlier, and I want to say this up front. I said this last time. This is not, apologetics is not about winning an argument. Okay? As much as I like to win arguments, and I bet you do too, and my own sinful pride, and it's there, I like to win arguments. Ask my wife, which I never win with her. So, but I like to argue too in some sense. But we're not after that. We're actually after someone's heart. And that's why I pulled out to you last time that passage in 1 Peter, where Peter says, you're actually commanded to give a defense for what you believe. There was a great theologian, his name's R.C. Sproul, said that everyone's a theologian. Well, that's absolutely true. If you're a Christian, you're a theologian. Everyone's a theologian. Whether you're not even a Christian, you're a theologian. You have a theology. But I would argue that if you're a Christian, not only are you a theologian, you are an apologist as well. You are commanded to give a defense and to do it with loving gentleness and humility. And there's the catch to do that. So, with that being said, let's get into this. This is the topic of all topics. And so what I want to do today is to give you, there's all kinds of ways to argue this. And some of these are more difficult to explain than others, and I don't want to do that. So I hopefully will use a lot of illustrations today to kind of work through some things. So whatever kind of age group that you're into, you're in, to kind of help us through this. But I have two passages to look to this morning. So I have that on your handout. One of them is the passage itself, and one's a reference to the passage, which you should know really well. First one's is Romans 1, and the other is Psalm 19. In case you've forgotten what Psalm 19 says, let me read that really fast. The psalmist says this, that God has revealed, that the heavens proclaim God's handiwork, that the heavens declare the glory of God and the sky proclaims his handiwork. Day after day, this is this metaphorical speech, day after day pours out speech that night after night reveals the knowledge of God. Well, Paul takes that same idea and pulls it over into Romans as well. And Paul says this in Romans 1. So I'm going to pick out a couple little passages here, and I've underlined them, one of them in particular, in your handout. Paul says this, for the wrath of God is revealed from the heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. So what is that truth? Well, what can be known about God is plain to them. By the way, this is an indictment for everybody, all of us, everywhere. Because God has shown it to them. What has he shown? Well, he's shown them his invisible attributes. What kind of invisible attributes? Well, Paul says, this is verse 20, namely, his eternal power and his divine nature that's been clearly perceived. Manifestum is the word here in the Latin. It's been manifestly perceived. There's no denying it. Well, how's that so? And Paul says, well, it's been so ever since the creation of the world. And then this really nice phrase that Paul uses on the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, in the things that have been made. It's the created order that we see. And then Paul says this, because of that, well, they're without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. They became futile in their thinking. And their foolish hearts were darkened, and claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of God for the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and images and creeping things as well. We are religious. We will worship something. If nothing else at the end, we'll worship ourselves. What's really clear here in this passage, and I've had a lot of conversations, not a lot, but I've had conversations with several students and adults who claim to be atheists. And I usually try to play, I tell them, I'm going to play my cards up front. I'm going to tell you what I think. And they usually don't like this. But I pull it from this passage as well. And I tell them this. that I really think that you think that you're an atheist. I don't doubt that. But here's the deal, according to Paul. Atheism is not an intellectual problem. It's a moral problem. And it's a moral problem in the sense of what Paul says, that we fundamentally know there's a God and we hate this God that we know of. And we suppress that knowledge in our own sin. And that's really clear. I mentioned last time I talked to you about agnosticism, being an agnostic, being an atheist, and then there's this new thing, supposedly, that's come on the scene called anti-theism, which is this, not only this disbelief in God, this hatred toward, isn't it funny that you would hate the very thing that you don't think exists to begin with? Just kind of funny, right? But that's kind of where we're at today. So what I want to do today is to be kind of hopefully really practical with this and to give you some tools to help you work through and talk through, to not win an argument, but to help people understand, hey, the very fact that you can see the created order in the things of this world actually not only suggests there's a God, actually proves there's one and proves it necessarily as well. So some really good tools in your toolbox to do that. There's a famous American educational psychologist who said this once about tools, and he meant this obviously metaphorically, which is a really good quote. He said, if the only tool that you have in your toolbox is a hammer, you tend to treat everything as though it's a nail. If the only tool that you have in your toolbox is a hammer, you tend to treat everything as though it were a nail. Now, obviously what he's after with that is you need other tools to help you do a job. And a hammer's a great tool. But how about if we had some other things that go along with that hammer? Because you may run into things that are not nails, right? And so those are some of the things we want to look at today. So let me give you an overview of really quick of what some things I want to look at today. Four arguments that I want to present to you for the existence of God. And some of these I'll spend a little bit more time on, and some of them I will zip through. Number one. So I'm just giving you the quick rundown, and then we'll go to it. Number one is called the transcendent argument. You see that on your sheet, the transcendent argument. That's an argument that essentially says this, that the very idea of knowledge, of logic, of knowing, well, that can't just happen by chance. We're not just grown-up germs with just molecules bouncing around in our head. You are very much aware of the fact that you're in this room right now. As a matter of fact, you're aware of this room, and you're aware of the world around you. That can't happen by sheer chance. That can't happen over a long period of time, no matter how much time. That's usually the solving equation for a lot of atheism, is do you have to have a lot of time, which still doesn't always solve problems. Matter of fact, sometimes it compounds problems. So we'll get to that one in a second, the transcendent argument. Number two is the creation argument. Sometimes this is called the cosmological argument. This is probably one you're most familiar with. So what's a cosmological argument? It's a first cause. So this was put forth in the 12th century by people like Aquinas, who a lot of people today dismiss him. I think he's probably one of the leading intellectuals in the church, in church history, is Aquinas. Aquinas is the first one to kind of use this idea. I'm going to kind of update that argument a little bit. And once again, hopefully give you kind of a practical way to think through that. Number three is the design argument, which is a really fascinating argument today, especially what this is called the teleological argument. Now, that's a huge word, I know. It's from the Greek word telos, which means goal or purpose or design. Okay, so the teleological argument is the design argument. And there's a whole movement today in what's called intelligent design. And I was going to bring one of the books today. I didn't, not to give away, but just to give you a title. And maybe when we get to that, I'll give you the title of that as well. One of my undergraduate degrees is in zoology, which is like biology. So I have a couple of undergrad degrees, and that's one of them. So I got immersed into this very early on. I had evolutionary ecology classes, evolutionary biology classes. So I understand what's kind of behind all that argument. But what we see today is something really interesting that's happening in the world of all places, evolutionary biology. They're rethinking. I don't know if you know this. They're rethinking their whole ideas especially when it comes to Darwinism. And there's published literature on this that's in peer-reviewed academic journals that they're rethinking these ideas because of one of the things I want to talk about today. So we'll get to that one. The last one, the last one's maybe the hardest one, is called the ontological argument. So I'll probably treat that really quickly. But so what is ontology? Ontology is the study of being. Okay, and that still may not make a lot of sense to you. But remember last week when we talked about with Acts 17, Paul says, he quotes Epimenides. And in this quote, Paul says that this unknown God that we worship, which is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in him we live, we move, and we have our being. Paul's drawing on that, right? He's quoting this ancient Greek poet to do that. So this was put forth by a guy named Anselm. And when people read this, some people are convinced this is the greatest argument for the existence of God. Other people think this is the craziest argument for the existence of God because it's so hard to understand. So I'm going to bring that one down into maybe a quick phrase or two to kind of help us through that along the way. Okay, let's get going. You ready? Here we go. Number one. This is the transcendent argument. The transcendent argument. So what I want to do is to come back to this drawing that I put up on the board last time. So this is the dominant worldview today, okay, which is naturalism. And naturalism says this, that everything that is explainable is explainable by means of the natural world, the physical world. And because of that, this is a closed system. There's nothing outside of that. There's no thing outside of that. So they would argue, which is what we see, they would argue there's no such thing as God. There's no such thing as absolute truth. So I gave you that example of my former student last time. He was in a communications class, right? Communication research class. And the teacher said, put up the statement, said there's always an absolute truth. My student says yes. The teacher says wrong. We work through why that's a problem, right? Well, one of the things I didn't mention to you is that this teacher was applying mathematical concepts to different cultures, which is totally fine. We talked about the idea of a relative statement. Well, what's funny about that is this. So here's where the transcendent part of it comes in. Is that even the fact she's applying numbers, and she's applying them relatively to every group of people that she's studying, even this idea comes to the forefront. What's the answer to that? Very good. 2 plus 2 equals 4. Okay. So why is this so important? Because underneath it, that's something that's an absolute truth. By the way, how long has 2 plus 2 equal 4? Well, that's right. It's been always. Now, is that dependent upon you? No. Was there a time when you did not exist? Yes. Prior to that, 2 plus 2 was what? 4. Ladies and gentlemen, there'll be a time in this room where everybody, I hate to tell you this, everybody in this room will no longer exist, at least in the physical form, right? And guess what? 2 plus 2 will be 4. Now, what's so interesting about the transcendent argument is this, that there is truth. And you say to, I've said this to people, and they'll say, well, I don't agree with that. So I'll say it back to them, well, are you saying there's no such thing as truth? And they'll say, yes. And I'll say, well, what you just told me is a what? Is a truth. You can't escape this. Here's the deal. If you have a system, if you have a worldview, which is what we have here, if you have a paradigm, and your paradigm, your worldview, hinges on the fact that everything has to be explained within the box. If you can explain one thing that exists outside the box, guess what happens to this worldview? It goes away. Why? I'll say it again. If you have a worldview, this is the dominant worldview today, which is naturalism. Materialistic naturalism means the same thing. And everything in the known universe is explained by physical cause. right? Everything gets rise to itself. If you have one thing outside that box, just one, then the whole system falls apart and you have to have a new model. Why? Because if one thing can fall off or be out of it, more things can as well. So what kinds of things can do that? So example. So this is where you have to stay with me a little bit. So one of the physical laws that we see in the universe today is the law of gravity. Okay? Which we're all familiar with. Let me demonstrate. I just demonstrated to you the law of gravity, right? That's what's keeping this pen and all of us in our seats, right? Could you have another world, a possible world, in which gravity did not exist? Yes. Now, it wouldn't be great. It may not work well, right? But you can have other possible, this is where it gets strange, right? You can have other possible worlds where gravity doesn't exist. Gravity is what's called a contingent law. It's dependent upon things. It's dependent upon the way this world is set up. Let me ask you this. So last time I introduced you to what's called the law of non-contradiction, where A cannot be A and non-A at the same time in the same way. What does that mean? Well, I can't say to you, this is a pin and this is not a pin at the same time and in the same relationship. That makes no sense. Right? So let me ask you this. Can I have another world, possible world, where the law of logic doesn't exist, where the law of non-contradiction doesn't exist? And the answer to that is no. Well, why not? Because even in that world, you can't say that world would exist and not exist at the same time. So, yeah, this becomes really heady, I know, but just in this one sense, that one argument alone gets rid of this whole system. Let me say it a different way. Okay? I'll let you jot these down because I don't have these in your handout. But let me say it this way. Number one is this argument. Truth exists. Truth exists. So if there's anything outside this box, which we know that there are, we know there's truth, and we know that it exists. Well, if you say once again that it doesn't exist, well, you've told me something that's a truth, right? You're saying that it doesn't exist. We know that it exists. 2 + 2 = 4. It's always equal 4. The law of non-contradiction exists. Another thing, it can't change. We use the term here, which is called immutability. So if you're in biology class and a cell mutates, well, what does that mean? It changes, right? And if you have a tumor inside your body, you've got an over mutations of cells that's going on. It's got multiple changing that's going on, right? It's over proliferation of change. What we know that truth can't change. It's always been. Well, that leads to this. It's eternal. Nothing in this box, ladies and gentlemen, is eternal. Everything in this box goes away. So this building will go away. Our physical bodies, until the point we're resurrected, everything goes away in this system. This is why naturalism, they don't know what to do with something like this. Truth exists. Truth is unchangeable. Can't change. It's eternal. Truth is mental. This is kind of a hard one. But truth is not something that has a physical quantity to it. Even Aristotle understood that. That's why he said that truth, logic, is the instrument. It doesn't tell us what to think. It tells us how to think. And it's mental in that sense. And yet, truth is superior to the human mind. Now, why would I say that? Because if truth is only dependent upon your mind and mine, and all of us someday will die, that would presuppose the fact that truth would what? That truth would die. And we know that's not true. This has always been. So truth exists. Truth can't change. Truth's eternal. Truth is mental. Truth is superior to the human mind. And then this last one. What do you think the last one might be? Well, if it's presupposed the fact that it's mental, it's of a mind, and we know that your mind and my mind, at least in the sense, is not eternal, then this is truth is from God. Truth is from a mind. And this might, look at the characteristics of this. Now, here's the subtlety with this. Truth is not God. Okay? But truth is a part of God's nature. He's rational. And that's kind of a dirty word sometimes, especially in American Christianity, because we've been told, we've kind of sold this bill of goods, that anything of the mind is therefore bad. And I'm arguing that it's actually not. Matter of fact, remember back that example I gave last time of the means of saving faith? The data, the notitia, the assensus, and yeah, I can't get you to saving faith. That's the Holy Spirit's work. But the content of Christianity, of evangelism, comes not through the heart first. It comes through the mind. This is the argument of what's called, why is it called transcendent argument? Because this argument of truth transcends this box. There's something beyond this box. We know that. Paul's arguing that as well. This is called the transcendent argument. There's different ways to say that. So I'll stop here. That's a lot I've kind of thrown at you a little bit. And then I'll give you some more practical examples from some of these others. Questions over this? Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. So he asked the question, when I say the word truth, do I mean absolute truth? And I absolutely mean that. Yes. And why is it called absolute? Once again, I gave you the example between a relative statement last time and and the idea of that and relativism, right? My relative statement last time was Brad's tall. Well, compared to what? Right, it's a relative statement. Compared to me, he's tall. Compared to LeBron James, he's a dwarf. Right, he's shrimpy. Right, that's a relative statement. We know that, but we're looking for something to be absolute. And the absolute nature of truth is this: that it is always, and it has always been. It's a great question. All right. So if you're sitting there thinking, I don't know what he's talking about. So I want to show you a couple of, hopefully some really practical illustrations as we get into a little bit of this further, okay? So that's one of them. This is called the transcendent. You probably want to email me, ask me some questions, come up and ask me later. That would be great. Number two, which I want to spend a little bit of time on. Number two is called the cosmological argument. It's called a first cause argument, okay? This is built on a fundamental question. And yeah, it's a philosophical question, but I think it's a question that everybody in here can relate to in some way. And the question is simply this. Why is there something rather than nothing? Okay? So let me pose it to you a different way. I'd like for you to pretend that there was a time when there was absolutely nothing. No space, no time, and just for pretend's sake, there's no God. There's nothing. Okay? There was a time there was absolutely nothing. What would there be now? So I'm going to stop here for a second, and I'd like for you to turn to the person next to you for about 10 seconds and answer that question. So I'll say it again. If there was a time and there's absolutely nothing, zero, no God, no time, no space, no matter, no energy, nothing. what would there be now? So I'll give you a second to think about that. Talk to your neighbor. Have a cup of coffee. You're thinking, I didn't sign up for this. This is crazy. The only nothing that's happening is in my head, right? Your teacher's head. Okay. What's the answer? And the answer is nothing. You got it. Ding, ding. That's right. The answer is absolutely nothing. Now, that sounds silly. That sounds maybe, come on. I've had many conversations with students who claim to be atheists, and I hit them right off with this question. If you're telling me that everything arose by whatever your explanation is, tell me how this works. Explain this. I really want to know how this works. And if you think about it, there's only four possibilities that explains all of reality. Matter of fact, this is called the prime reality question. Why is there something rather than nothing? I'll write it on the board. This is called the prime reality question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Okay? Now, I want to illustrate this, and this person doesn't know I'm going to do this, so I'm totally dependent. I have no idea what this person's going to say, but I thought, how am I going to take some really kind of heavy theological, philosophical concept and give it to you so that you can explain it to your 8-year-old grandchild, whatever? Okay? So he may not want to do this, but William, will you help me? I really need help. Come on up. Okay. Give William a hand. Yeah. It's my buddy William. So, just to set the stage here, William, did you know I was going to ask you to do this?
No.
Would you have done this?
Maybe.
Okay. That's about as best. Okay. Well, come up and have a seat, William. All right? So, I have a son named Titus who's pretty close to William's age. I've got a son, Gideon, who's a little bit older. If I were going to try to work through this, and I have, this is what I would probably kind of work through with my own sons. This is what I'm encouraging you to think about with your own kids as well. Okay? And I set this up because, remember, your kids, there's these competing worldviews. Naturalism is the competing worldview. We've just demolished that one, hopefully, to your satisfaction. That's not a very good worldview because it's not consistent. We want a consistent worldview. And yet, if we know anything about God at all, it's this. Yes, we know more about him than this, but at least this very basis we know this, that God is creator. And the reason I run to that example is because Paul runs to that example. In Acts 17, Paul tells them, you're missing something, boys, and what you're missing is the fact there's a creator. And the creator who made the whole world. This is where Paul starts. And then he moves into the Epimenides quote and all the other cool stuff. Same thing in Romans. Paul, that passage I just read to you, Paul goes to the very epicenter of it all. He says, God's creator. And therefore we know he exists because of the natural world around us. Okay. So what I'd like to do is to think about this for a second, this building. Okay. And I'm going to have William help me with this. Okay. This building. Okay. So, do you agree, William, that this building exists?
Yes.
Good. Okay. So, I'd like for us to think about this as an illustration of this building. That the building, in a sense, would equal the universe. The something that we live in. So, we're all in this room right now. And there's really only four explanations for this building. My wife's an architect. She might come up with another one. I don't think so. But there's only four explanations for this building. Okay. So one of, and I'm going to work through this with William in just a second. So one of the explanations is this. This building is an illusion. Okay? William, do you know what I mean by that?
No, I have no idea.
He has no idea. Good. What do we mean when we say something is an illusion? Help William out here. It's not real. So it's just pretend. Do you agree that this building is not pretend, that it's real? Yeah, of course, right? How do you know that?
Because I'm standing on it solid.
You can't beat that rationale, okay? Number two, by the way, I can eliminate that because William eliminated that for me, right? It's pretty easy. Number two, this building could have created itself. William, do you know what I mean by that?
Not really.
Help William out here. Help me out. What do we mean when we say that the building created itself? That the building assembled itself on its own. Didn't need any help. There was no outside help. That the wood pulled itself in, the tile pulled itself in, the chairs pulled out the ore out of the ground, all the plastic, it melted itself. Do you buy that?
No.
Why not?
Because it can't do it.
Because it can't do it. So William has just articulated one of the pivotal points in not just theology, but in science. It's the law of ex nihilo nihil fit. So way to go. And ex nihilo nihil fit says this, out of nothing, nothing comes. Ex, where we get the word exit, see in the back of that sign back there, the word ex, out of? The word exit, ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing, nothing comes. Why? Because nothing can come. That's a crazy idea. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the dominant view today of how the world came to be. It created itself. I'm not making this up. That's the argument today. So, case in point, famous anti-theist today named Lawrence Krauss wrote this book called A Universe from Nothing. His premise is, he knows it's loony, but his premise toward the end of the book, he'll finally give up and say, I know this sounds kind of nuts, it's possible. The universe created itself. Now, you've been told, or at least I suspect you have, that Christianity, you lose your mind, right? You give up, it's faith for reason. I can't imagine something more irrational to say than that, that the universe created itself. But that's the argument. We'll come back to that one. Number three. So we have illusion, self-creation. What do you think the third thing might be?
Outer space aliens.
We'll get there. How about the fact this building's eternal and self-existent? That's a big word. Self-existent. And my handwriting's really poor, I know. We'll say eternal, I'll rewrite that. And self-existent. William, do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
What do I mean by that?
It means it'll last forever.
So William says it'll last forever. That's not quite what I mean, but it's there, right? Not only that it will last forever, but you got half of it right, but what else? It's always been here. Now, William, has this building always been here?
No.
How do you know that?
Because somebody had to build it.
Because somebody had, well, now, wait a second, you're jumping to my fourth point. No, William's right. And William's right because he's thinking logically. By the way, that's not something that I tricked him into. That's not something that Brad and Aaron taught him to be logical. That's something he was born with. The same way that you and I were born with that as well. We have the means and capacity to do those things. So, yes, it's absurd to think that this building is eternal and self-existent. So we're really only left with the last option. Can you guess what that last option is? Yes. That it's created. And it's created by a being, or at least some kind of intelligence, right? Now, if you work in...
What goes in our blank?
I'll give you that. Got to have the blanks, right? That it was created by a self-existent being. Thank you for saying that. So the question was, what about the last blank, for crying out loud? He didn't put the crying out loud on it. No. Let me run through the blanks, and then the reason I held off on the blanks, love the blanks, is that this is a really simple idea, but it's actually really profound too. And Williams knows this, right? You can't have a building that's an illusion. You could, but we all in here see the building, right? It's not self-created. It's not eternal. It had to be created by someone. So the blanks are this: that reality is an illusion, that reality B is self-created, that reality is self-existent or eternal, or that reality is created by a self-existent being. What in the world do I mean by a self-existent being? Well, self-existent being is this, something that's uncaused. So now you say, wait a second. This is a little illustration here. We had a being. That being was a person. That person was caused. How do you rectify this? Good question. So if we take this same idea and we apply it to the universe itself, this is how this works. So if I said to you that the universe is an illusion, you would probably say back to me, well, that's crazy, because we see it. Paul goes back to that by the things that have been made. So let's just do away with that. What about it's self-created? This is the dominant argument today, remember? This is it. That is an illogical impossibility. Why? Because for something to create itself, it would have to be before it was. This building, this universe would have to be and what? Not be at the same time and in the same relationship. That is a manifest absurdity. And people believe this. You can't get something from nothing. This violates two of the fundamental principles of not just theology, but of science. The law of non-contradiction and the law ex nihilo nihil fit. You can't get something from nothing in and of itself. That's irrational. And if you're worried about speaking up in class or presenting an argument because you're not sure if the person can present to you a different argument, I present to you there's no greater argument than this. So hopefully we can see really quick, we can rule that out. That's craziness. Number three, here's the tricky part. We see at least this, right? That something has to be self-existent. And it's either the universe itself or it's a being. In this case, God. So something self-existent. And this is where a lot of times people run to number three and go, okay, well, why can't the universe be self-existent? Why can't there be some pulsating core in the universe? It's a good question, right? It's a really good question. So while I've helped, and William has helped me through this part, for those of you in here who have people in your life that are a little bit older, and they may want something a little more sophisticated than the building argument, let me get a little bit more sophisticated with those of you, okay, just for a second. Why we say that the universe is not eternal. And I'm going to appeal to science to do that, okay? So let me give you two really quick things. Two discoveries in the 20th century. One is a guy by the name of Edwin Hubble. So you may have known him. He has a famous telescope named after him. It's always broken, right? Floats in space. Great invention. It's always broken, right? Hubble made this remarkable discovery at what's called the Palomar Laboratory in Southern California. And he discovered through these dome telescopes that the galaxies around us were actually moving away from us. So let me give you an illustration. So I have a balloon here. I made some squiggly marks on it. You can play with the balloon in a second. Okay. Maybe you can blow it up. Now, if you blew the balloon up, which is stuck together, what would happen? It won't blow. If you blew, this is why I get an illustration. It expands, right? And Hubble knew that the universe was expanding, which meant it had to have a start point. At the same time, across the ocean, there's a really famous scientist. He had crazy hair, and his name was Albert Einstein. And Einstein had come to the same conclusion mathematically. But here's the problem. Einstein held on to the old 19th century belief that the universe was eternal. And everything that he was coming up with was saying, it's not eternal. It actually has a beginning. And Einstein didn't know what to do with this. So you know what he did? He fudged his data. He created what he called a cosmological constant that he factored into his equation to make the universe static. Hubble invites Einstein over to America. It's this really famous scene. He goes into the laboratory in Southern California. He looks through the microscope. He looks through the telescope. He comes back out. Hubble's in the background with a pipe in his mouth. And Einstein says this: "I see the need for the beginning of a universe." That's my terrible German. He sees the need for a beginning of a universe. Thank you. He knew that the universe had a beginning. Now, that's one thing. The second great scientific discovery came about in the 1960s with a guy named Stephen Hawking. Actually, it's two guys, Stephen Hawking and a guy named Penrose. And they worked on, they solved, there will be no quiz on this later, they solved Einstein's field equations on gravity. And what they determined was this, that the universe not only was expanding, but it had, if you shrunk it back down, if you take this balloon and you what's called back extrapolate, you let all the air out of it, you come back to a point, what's called a point of singularity. Okay? Now, when you and I think point, we think this. That's not what they meant. This is a mathematical term. And the idea is this, that when matter gets crunched down, it starts to curve in on itself. And it gets tighter and tighter and tighter until Hawking and Penrose said this, called the singularity theorem, that eventually you get to absolute zero. Now, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, how much stuff can you put in absolute zero? Nothing. The universe is not eternal. The universe had a beginning. That leaves us with the last point, that the universe had a beginning, yes, but it had a creator. Now, I want to stop here for a second. This creator is necessary. We have to have him. It's logically necessary. Why? Because if there ever were a time when there was nothing, there would be what? So I'm going to stop here because I asked you earlier that you might want to anticipate a question. I'm anticipating a question. Anybody want to ask me this question? Yes.
Who created God?
Who created God? There's always the question, right? Well, if you think about it this way, nothing created God. God is self-existent and eternal. Because if God were created, he'd be a creature. And he would have to have a creator. And that creator would have to have a creator. And that creator would have to have a creator as well. And what you get is what's called an infinite regression. And if you have an infinite regression of creations, you never get to here. Example, if you have an infinite number of dominoes that have to fall before you get to domino X, how long will it take before you get to domino X? You'll never get to domino X. There has to be something that's eternal, that's self-existent. As Paul says, that lives, moves, and that we live, move, and have our being in. This is God. This, by the way, this is the God that reveals himself to Moses in the Midianite wilderness. Notice the sacred name that God gives to Moses. He says, which is the present tense of the verb to be. Not I was, I will be, or I'm becoming. I am. This is God's eternal nature. Matter of fact, even the bush itself that doesn't get consumed represents God's eternal nature. This is the God that we're talking about. So here's the question I've anticipated. I don't know if you've thought about it yet. That was the second one. It's a good one. I just said to you a few minutes ago that creation, being something self-created, right, ex nihilo, out of nothing, makes no logical sense. And yet, as a fundamental doctrine, we know that God created ex nihilo, out of nothing. So what are you saying here? You told me one hand that creating ex nihilo is a logical absurdity, and now you're telling me that, well, we believe that God created ex nihilo. So have I just set up this massive thing, this contradiction? Do you understand the question? So how do we resolve this? If you don't understand, that's a good. Thank you for saying that. How can it be that this building or the universe can't create itself, it can't create of itself, and yet we hold in Christianity that God created out of nothing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He didn't reformulate matter. He created. Augustine in the 5th century talked about this, a divine fiat. That's not a small Italian car, by the way. A divine fiat is a command. It's a command. So how do you rectify that? Well, it's quite simply this. When Augustine said that God created ex nihilo out of nothing, he didn't mean that there was no God. He meant there was nothing, but there was something behind it all, and that's God himself. God is the one who's self-existent and eternal. Not the universe. That's why. The universe can't create itself in and of itself, but we can have an all-powerful, omniscient, self-existent, eternal being. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what we do have. And there's no way around this argument. That's both logically necessary. You have to have that. Why do you have to have it? Because there would be nothing now. Ladies and gentlemen, we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he is much more than an uncaused cause, but he's not less than that. He is the self-existent eternal one. That's who we worship. The last one is called, so if you go to the next handout, so I'll let you process that a little bit. The next one's called the teleological argument. This is the argument from design. You can sit down, William. Thank you. Give William a hand. I'll set him up here. So the teleological argument is this. It's the argument from design. And the argument goes like this. What if astronomers found a box floating in space, a red box, and this is fiction. They pull the box, they find the box, they go retrieve the box, they get the box, they open the box up, and what they find investigating this box is that it has some really unique qualities about it. It can self-replicate. It has its own power source. It has a digital code that reprograms itself. So if you're a computer programmer, you have to have information, right, to get your computer to do something. This box has all that. Okay? What would the astronomers conclude after finding this box? Yes. There's something there, right? What would they conclude? This box has can self-replicate, it has its own power source, has a digital code that replicates itself, that has information in it. So what would they assume about the box? Has a purpose? Somebody designed it. There's intelligence designed it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you don't have a box in this room. You've got circles, and there are millions of them in your body. They're called cells. And one of the great discoveries in the 20th century is the DNA, which is a complex code of information. So this was founded by Watson and Crick. They found this in the 1950s. And DNA, which is the code of life, has four base nucleotides, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. They pair up inside. This is where the information, this is digital code. This is where the information is coded and stored in your DNA. This is specified, complex information. So the last thing, what does that mean? Specified, complex information. What's the difference between complex information and specified complex information? So let me give you an example. If you're driving your car in Fayetteville, you're coming south on College, and you were to happen to look up at Mount Sequoia, and there are these white stones that have assembled themselves, and they've spelled out all these words. Now, that would either be because of wind and erosion that pushed all these white stones together. That's complex information. It doesn't tell us anything. All we have is just a bunch of letters up on Mount Sequoia. We either have that because of wind and erosion a lot of time, highly improbable, but probable, or somebody put them there, some kind of intelligence there. That's one thing. What we have in the DNA is this. We don't just have complex information. We have specified complex information. What does that mean? If I take all these letters, hopefully I wrote this right. And what if they were to spell welcome to Fayetteville? So what if you drove in on South College, look up on Mount Sequoia, and see a sign by stones that have been assembled together, white rocks, and it spells out welcome to Fayetteville? You got two options. That can either be cause of a lot of time and a lot of chance, or it's there because there is an intelligence behind that. That's what these nucleotide bases do. They spell out information. And by the way, it's not a mantra of repeating it's not like zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zeros and ones. This is four bases that are arranged in a particular way, and you can't have life without them. Here's what's called the DNA mystery. And it's not really a mystery to us, but it is to a lot of evolutionary biologists. Here's the mystery really quick. We know what the DNA molecule looks like. We know where information is stored on the DNA, which is in these nucleotide, these bases. We know where it's stored. Here's what evolutionary biologists have no idea. Where this information came from. To build animals, you have to have specified complex information. It's kind of the old chicken and egg syndrome that they don't know how to solve this. You have to have a start point. You have to have information. We're built with proteins. These DNA molecules build proteins. You can't have one without the other. Where did this come from? And this is why in the evolutionary biology world, they're rethinking this whole idea of design. Okay? The last one, 30 seconds. I told you this would be the hardest one. This is number 4 on your list. I know I'm talking fast. This is called the ontological argument. And it says this. This is by Anselm. That God is that which nothing greater can be conceived. That God is that which nothing greater can be conceived. And I've heard people say, this is the dumbest argument I've ever heard, because I can think of God that can't be conceived. So what does he mean by that? That God is that which nothing greater can be conceived. Well, I think Anselm's using this sort of as a standard. And here's why. Back to that, when I pulled William up here earlier, and I said to you that the universe itself, there's only four possibilities. It's either an illusion, it created itself, it's eternal, or it was created by a self-existing eternal being that has to be. So what does Anselm mean by this? Well, he means this, that this God that we worship cannot not be. So let you write this down. I'm an English teacher. I know that's a double negative. But he means this, that God cannot not be. God cannot not be. What does that mean, God cannot not be? Well, once again, if there were a time when there was nothing, zero, there would be nothing now. That's not just a first cause argument. That's an ontological argument. That's a being argument as well. We have to have a being that's intelligent, that's eternal. So if you take all these strands that I've quickly run through, and by the way, I know fully explain all that, but you need to be reading deeply on this. But if you take all these strands and pull them together, this is a formidable argument. Just the argument number 2 is a formidable argument to make for the existence of God.